Accession number 22572, Reel 1.
Reverend L.E.M. Claxton, Reel 1. Was there any tradition of military service in your family?
None whatsoever. Well, I had a cousin, I think, who was in the war, that's all.
You mentioned that you were in the OTC at St. Paul's School. Can you remember what you did there, what the syllabus of training was and what you learned?
Well, we had a camp. We went to the camp once a year down to the Devon coast. We spent most of our time swimming, I think. We didn't do very much training. We did a bit and we had a camp and we got the idea of a camp into our heads, really.
Do you remember anything about the tactical training that you did on the camp?
Pardon me?
The tactical training that you did.
What training?
Tactical.
Sorry, go on.
The training in tactics.
Tactics? No, yeah. none whatever.
None whatever.
I wasn't in very long. I joined rather late in life. I wasn't very a keen member of the OTC. We went on parade during the week. And that was that. But I wasn't a good member of it. I really wanted to join the Navy, actually, when the war was threatening in 1938, but it turned out differently.
I was going to ask you, you were growing up 1920s, 1930s, can you remember when you first developed the idea that there was going to be another war?
I think it was 1938, really, as late as that. There was the time when Chamberlain went to Munich and a bit of paper and all that business, which everybody remembers now. It was then that I thought I would join the Navy, because I was a curate, you see, in a place called Dartford. But I had a letter from the Chaplain General. I think my name was forwarded by the Bishop, saying, would I be prepared to join the Army? And I thought, well, yes. I mean, I'd be in the wrong queue, but I'll tell them when I get there, you see, sort it out. Didn't happen, because there was no interview. I was called up. In September, before the war, I was called up two or three days before the war and sent to Aldershot, where I put on uniform.
You were saying that you expected war in 1938. Did you have any ideas about the way in which it would be fought in a military sense?
Absolutely not. I didn't think about it, really. I joined the National Fire Service as a war effort. I thought I'd do something.
What happened when you got to Aldershot?
Oh, we were interviewed. We were put in a nice billet with two old ladies. There was another chap and me in the same boat as I was, really. And we spent our time digging them an air raid shelter. We were there about a month, I suppose. We built a lovely air raid shelter. And we fitted out the uniform and had the lessons in first aid and that kind of thing, you know. But nothing about, about military tactics. The only thing I can remember was we were told that if somebody salutes you, you just don't salute back. You always say, you salute back, of course, but you always say, good morning. That's the thing which remained with me.
You're saying that you were told you've got to say good morning when you saluted. Who was telling you these things?
The Assistant Chaplain General, who was in charge of the incoming recruits to the Army, Royal Army Chaplain's Department.
How many of you were there as recruits?
There were about 40 of us, I suppose. They were a mixed bag. I mean, there were people who were enthusiastic for war. There were one man, particularly, I remember very distinctly, had put a notice on his church door, there would be no services in this church until further notice, and just left and joined up. But that's unusual, but we were mostly youngish people. But quite undisciplined and doing our own thing, you know.
What about your view? Were you enthusiastic for the war?
Me?
Yes.
No, I was not interested in military things at all, or very much in naval things. But I did have a sort of hunch to join the Navy.
Mm. Why were you so keen on the Navy compared to the Army?
I don't know. I like the sea, for one thing. I like the sea. I love cruising.
Do you remember learning anything else at Aldershot besides the question of saluting and saying good morning?
Well, how to put on uniform, that's all. How to dig a, how to slit trench, and how to make an air raid shelter, which, that's all. Nothing else, really. No.
How long were you there?
Oh, about a month. Then we all went over to France. It was called the Pool of Padres. The Pool of Padres, commanded by a gunner major. The most uncomfortable command he ever had, I think, because none of us did what we were told, and he looked terrified the whole time. We sailed across to Saint-Nazaire, I think it was, and we were billeted in a lovely little hotel. And well, we built it with French families, quite delightful. It was there I learnt what a French lunch is like, starting at 12 and finishing at 2, with children shouting and talking and corks popping. We had a room next door to the family room, actually. Lovely people, and they took us driving around the countryside on Sundays, and we were very, very pleasant. Very near La Baule, a place called La Baule. It was actually a place called Guérande, a walled city. And then eventually, the assistant chaplain general, not the same one, of course, the one in BOR, in wherever it was, came, and we all stood up in turn, sitting around this table in the mess, and he looked it up and down, and then wrote a few notes down, and we were posted somewhere. And my posting was to the 2nd Dorset, no, the 5th Brigade of the 2nd Infantry Division, which are up on the Belgian frontier.
Do you know why you were chosen for that particular brigade? Any reason?
Well, I suppose he thought I looked suitable or something. I don't know, but there it was. I had a nice journey up. I put my foot in it in Paris because I got on the wrong floor. I was staying there for the night. I got on the wrong floor and walked into a room with a young lady about to change. And I was on the wrong floor. It didn't matter. I was very green.
What other units were in the 5th Infantry Brigade? You said the Dorsets were there. Who else was in it?
Well, I arrived at night at a place called Marchiennes, which was the B echelon of the Dorsets, and a 5th Brigade, really. And I was given a most wonderful welcome. I had no idea that people could be so nice. They sat me down at dinner. They were having dinner, and they gave me a glass of wine, and they talked to me, this and that. And the young officer took me to my billet, and very comfortably, and wouldn't leave me, you see, at all. And then the next day, I was given a motor car and a driver and sent up to join the battalion, the Dorsets. I had to go to 5th Brigade first. And when I got to 5th Brigade, they handed me my posting order. It hadn't arrived till that morning. I arrived before the posting order. And then I went to the battalion, where I was treated very well after that, but not with the same sort of care that I've been used to. I fell in love with the Dorsets at once. There was no question of it. But you see, the thing was that I didn't know till afterwards that they thought I was a spy. Of course, Hitler was using the dog collar to conceal some of his spies. And that's why they took such care of me and wouldn't let me out of their sight, more or less.
And do you know how long it was before they realised that you were not a spy?
Well, as soon as my posting order arrived, because they knew this strange man arrived with a dog collar, and said he was so-and-so, they knew nothing about me till they got the posting order.
And who else was in the brigade? What other battalions were in the brigade?
The other battalions in the brigade were the Camerons and the Worcesters. I took part many years later on the VJ Day Parade, where we assembled on Birdcage Walk. And I couldn't find any Dorsets, but I did find 6 Cameron Highlanders wearing kilts. And I went up to them and said, may I march with you, you see? And they said, come on, Padre, come on, like a weed drammy. And then they sang me a little song, which was the Worcesters on the left and the Dorsets on the right, the Camerons in the middle, and we taught them how to fight. Well, I couldn't let them get away with that, so I sang the song that I learnt in the Dorsets. What would they do without the Dorset boys? like just like the navy on the sea. If it wasn't for the Dorset boys, where would England be? Fuck it if I know. Where would England be? I said, what's that funny word you put in the last line? I didn't know what it meant.
It must have been a very brutal education for you, dealing with soldiers.
Oh, yes. I started my education when I joined the Dorsets, I think.
What about the Worcesters? Did they have a song?
They had a Roman Catholic padre. Mm. I was the only Church of England one. The Camerons, of course, had a Church of Scotland padre. Oh. A very great friend of mine.
What were the battalion actually doing when you joined them?
They were sitting, digging slit trenches on the Belgian frontier and looking out for the enemy. It was a pretty easy life, really, once they'd dug, done all the digging. My great pal and I, Cameron Highland, we joined on the same day, and he used to wear his kilt, which was strictly forbidden by the Royal Army Chaplain's Department, but nobody else worried about it. And he wore a balmoral and a kilt. He came swinging along to Rumishi, which is the little village you're in, and he said, I've just seen some jocks digging a slit trench. And I said, and they said, Monsieur, travaillez-vous? I said, and they said, we're no travailling, we're staying here.
What did you wear? What was your uniform outfit?
Pardon me?
What did you wear? What uniform did you wear?
Oh, I wore the ordinary army uniform with black buttons, just like everybody else, but my buttons were black. Mm. Chaplain's buttons, that was all. And dog collar.
Where were you living when you were with the Dorsets on the front?
Where was I living?
Yeah.
We were billeted in different little houses, scattered around the village. Everybody had their own billet. We had a mess, of course. But the mess was a bit of a bore, really, the headquarters mess, headquarters company and headquarters. And the commanding officer was a very distinguished and wonderful soldier. And he and his second in command were awful bores at dinner time because they sniffed the wine and decided it wasn't very good. And this kind of conversation went on. And don't forget, we were there for about 5 months before anything happened, really, and became very boring. Yeah. But I had a little car. And a driver, a Welsh driver called Solis. And we used to take people into Lille for one night a week to have a bath. And the drill was very simple. You hired a room in a hotel. You then had a lovely bath and lounged about and had tea sent up and cream buns and things. There was no kind of sign of a war at that time. And then you got dressed and you went down the bar and you sort of... Yes, you sort of had a drink and things, and then you had a lovely meal. Lovely food about the place at the time. And then it was too early to go home, so you went to a nightclub. Then that closed down. It was still too early to go home. So you went somewhere else. In fact, we went to a brothel, quite simply. And I wasn't wearing my dog collar then, of course. But you danced with the young ladies, and they said, Trey Bon upstairs. And I sat down at the piano, I played the piano a bit. And where I acquired my name, I'm always called Gus, you see, G-U-S. Mm. Everybody knows me as Gus, except my mother. Even my wife calls me Gus now. But I acquired the name in a brothel, which was 147 Rue Nationale, Lille. And I was playing the piano, and one of my young officers came and tapped me on the shoulder and said, Padre, oh, Padre, what about... And, of course, before I knew where I was surrounded by officers, young men, pointing the finger at me and saying, Padre, Padre, what are you doing here? So I said to this chap, later on, for heaven's sake, Sam, don't call me Padre. He said, well, what shall I call you? I said, call me Gus, if you like, call me anything you like. And that name stuck, and it's been with me ever since. Disgraceful way to find a name, isn't it?
Probably a very frequent one.
But I was very good. I didn't do anything wrong in the brothel. I used to keep my eye on them. Mm. And I prevent them from going upstairs. If I saw them going upstairs, I pulled them down again.
Mm. What did you see as being your primary role as chaplain to the battalion? What was your primary role, your main interest?
My main interest? In, well, I had the whole brigade to be Church of England Padre too.
Yes.
Well, first of all, taking services. I used to have a Sunday morning, which I had 8 services before lunchtime. Very short. Mm. They were scattered about the Belgian frontier.
Would this be devotions in the field? Devotions in the field?
Oh, yes. No. They were living in houses.
Ah.
Billets and halls and things like that. So it was. We always found a place for a church service. Mm. But I had very short services, and every now and then I'd have a communion service. I used to go to one particular place where the Camerons were, and there were 3 or 4, perhaps half a dozen jocks who had C of E, who wanted a communion. And one day I was there, and I noticed in the farmhouse we had the service, the farmer and his wife came and stood at the back. They didn't take communion, but they were very devout, and they watched with great interest. The following month, when I went there to do the same thing, I couldn't get into the farm. The farmyard is full of people. And the woman said to me, yes. I said, I was very strict in those days about denominations. Not now, but I was then. And I said to her, I am Church of England. She said, but you are Catholic. I said, I am Catholic. Well, that's what I said, no, I'm not. I am not French Catholic. I'm not Roman Catholic. I'm English Catholic. Mm. And a look of horror spread over her face, and she said, you are not of the sect of Henry VIII, are you? I said, well, you put it that way, madame, I am. And as if I'd fired a gun and they all disappeared, cleared like birds running away from a gun. Quite extraordinary.
What sort of attendances did you have at your
Well, there were church parades.
Services.
So for communion service, very small but devout. The church parades, of course, were there, and they'd had to go. In fact, the reason why I was sent up to join the Dorsets at that late stage, it was November 39, I think. They'd been there a few months. My predecessor had refused to take church parades. He said he wouldn't take them. So he was dispatched to a base hospital, and I was brought up from the pool of Padres.
So you were running services. What did you do during the rest of the week when you weren't doing the
I did everything. I joined, I became sports officer. Mm-hmm. All the things to do, you had to get around and know people and visit them. I became, people a bit suspicious of me at one time sometimes because they thought I asked too many questions. They thought I was, again, a spy or something, or a fellow traveller. But I don't know, there's plenty to do. Specifically, at that stage, little, but later on, of course, I got all kinds of jobs thrust upon me, like being sports officer, or being entertainment officer, or being education officer. There was a lot of idle time, spare time, and, of course, transport to Lille was one thing I spent one day doing.
You were saying that it got very boring because they dug in and then nothing was happening. Did this have a bad effect on the morale of the soldiers?
I suppose it did, rather. It did, rather. It took the edge off things. I don't think it was a bad effect, really, but we were bored, a bit bored. Mm. I think one battalion went down to the Maginot Line to see a bit of fighting for about a month. But there was always plenty to do to get round companies and see people and talk about their problems and that sort of thing. You did what you do in the civilian life. You get to know people and they tell you things and they share their difficulties with you.
And did you have many serious problems of a social
Not
nature?
Not at that stage. No. Not at that stage. We did get some leave, actually, at one point. Mm. We did get some leave, yes. About a week. And
was that back to the UK or was it in
France?
Yeah,
back in the UK, yes. Mm. Yes. There was no war at that time, you see. It was just what we call the phony war, very rightly so, too.
You mentioned that you were entertainments officer. Now, what sort of entertainments could you lay on?
Well, we got together concert parties. And the British soldier is marvellous on the stage. He can't learn a part. You can't give him a part to read. I mean, you can't put a play on. But you give him a picture in his mind of a situation, some silly situation, like somebody in a cafe or something. And you say, now you're doing so and so and so. You give him, don't tell him what to say. It all comes to him quite naturally. You can put on a very funny sketch if you give him the right sort of, the right scenario. And it went down with all that's something you can sing, of course. I played the piano a bit. I became, this was later on, really. I became the pianist of the dance band. They had a dance band. You know, stretcher bearers in the war are taken from the musicians of the band. And the Dorsets had a band. So we had a lot of quite good musicians among the stretcher bearers. And we could put on concerts and play things and have a dance band. This was later on when we were able to dance, but they called them the Flamers. They were a lovely lot of people. We had a double bass, two clarinets, and two trumpets, etc., etc. Drums, of course.
Did you organise dances then as well as...
Well, not then. There was nobody to dance with. But, I mean, when we got back to England later on, we did have dances. We organised dances, yes. That's right. And concerts. Mm.
And you mentioned also education. What sort of education did you lay
Well,
on?
There was a thing called ABCA, which you may have heard of.
Yes.
Where we were given leaflets. We talked about... this is much later on, really. Mm. I just saw the education business when we were in India later on.
Oh, no, I was thinking more about when you were in France.
No, nothing like that. There was none of that happened there.
None of that happened
except
there.
The concerts. We did have concerts. Mm. And there was no sport either.
Mm. No sport?
No, not in France, no. Mm. No. They might have played football, but I don't play football, so I don't know.
Did you have any contacts with the local French clergyman?
None whatever. Mm. None whatever. Mm. I never saw them. They seemed to disappear. Well, we were in a village, you know, and there were not many people about.
Mm. So what about the civilian population? Were they still in place, or were they...
They were very nice to us, actually. Very nice to us indeed. We were very hospitable. Mm. Towards the end of our time in Romaji, the company commander of headquarter company got fed up completely with the atmosphere in the mess at night. And he said, have our own mess. I was given the job of finding a suitable place for it. And I went round a number of houses and I found a place which was very nice, I thought, make a very nice mess. And the lady who owned the place, she said, oh, oui, monsieur, mais pas de zigzag, pas de zigzag. Whatever that meant, I could guess, really. And so it became known as the Zigzag Club. And we had great fun in the Zigzag Club. The whole atmosphere changed completely.
Who was in the club?
Well, all the members of headquarter company. Mm. But we had guest nights, you see. We asked the CEO and his second-in-command to a guest night. And I was PMC at the time. That's another thing I had to do, of course. I was PMC. And the first bottle of wine was presented to the colonel. He thought it was very, very good. But I gave him strict instructions. The second bottle would be rather cheap stuff. And he didn't know the difference. Mm. But we had great fun there. The Zigzag Club. There I met my very greatest friend of the war, the doctor. He wasn't the MO of the Dorsets. He was a sort of chap who stood in when the MO was away. And he really wanted to be a Dorset and later on became one, but that wasn't until we got back to England. Joe Chamberlain, a wonderful man.
When you were doing your day-to-day round of going around and meeting people and so on, what were your priorities? Were you primarily concerned with the spiritual health of the soldiers or their moral instruction or with their social well-being? What
I was concerned really with them as people, I think, to get to know them and we'll talk about this. I didn't talk much about religion, not much, unless they brought it up. If they raised the subject, then I would take it up. But I didn't ask them questions about religion unless they asked me questions.
Were there many who were seriously interested
in religious issues? Not many. They were typically British people. You know, they're very, very reluctant about their spiritual position. I mean, one doesn't go talking to visiting in a parish and talking. We talk about a general thing. You get to know people. That's really what you do. And then if they want to know, they will bring the subject up, and then you can perhaps give them some guidance in spiritual matters. I tell you something more, but this came much later on when I got back to England. I'll give you one example. Mm. Or should I do it now?
Might as well do it now.
Well, it was after we got back to... I'd been in BAOR, you see, at the time. I stayed in the army. Mm. I never meant to, but I liked it so much I stayed in it. And a place called Hilsey near Portsmouth was a barracks, and after a church service there was a man who used to, a civilian man, nothing to do with the army, he used to come to it regularly. And he asked me one day to go and see his wife. And I went round to see her. She couldn't leave the house because her daughter, who was 33, was bedridden and had been bedridden all her life. A very religious girl. She couldn't hear. Her mother had to interpret what I said, you see. And she had never been confirmed. And I thought that what would please her a lot would be to get her confirmed and to take her communion. They were delighted with this, so I gave her some instruction with her mother's interpreter. And the bishop came and confirmed her in her bed. Oh, before that happened, the day before, her mother took me in the front room of the house. Said, there's something I want to tell you. She said, when I was pregnant with Barbara, I didn't really want another child. And I tried to get rid of her by taking pills. And she said, when what's happened to Barbara is a punishment to me for what I did. Well, this poor lady for 33 years had carried this thing on her conscience and really believed that God was punishing her. That was the sort of situation. I had to get it into her head that this was not the case. God doesn't do that sort of thing, you see. So she was very much comforted. Then we went forward with the confirmation. And that's the kind of thing that happened, you see.
Well, that's a question of theology, isn't it? It's a question of theology.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And it's difficult to interpret sometimes, but you have to do your best to get a point across.
Did you find that soldiers asked you questions about matters of morality when you were in France?
Not much.
Not much.
Not much. We all knew what the moral code was. I mean, there was no such... I'll tell you another story that occurred on our way to India. Should I do that now? Mm-hmm. We arrived in Cape Town. I was on a ship. Two battalions and a brigadier, and two, of course, commanding officers. And when we got to Cape Town, we were allowed out for... We were there 4 days. We were allowed out for the first night. And the brigadier spoke to us, all the officers, and said, the last division which went through this port on the way back to Australia... They were sent back for some reason. They weren't very good. We had met them earlier. Went back with 75% of venereal disease. That is not going to happen to us. So every man who leaves the ship will carry with him, whether he likes it or not, 3 condoms. Well, now, I wouldn't have worried about that now. But I was a young man and rather sort of straight-laced, I suppose. And there were 2 other padres on board, including a Roman Catholic padre. And we 3 got together and we said, this is wrong. We can't have brigadiers telling you must carry condoms. So we formed up to the brigadier and we put our point of view. The Roman Catholic chap was very, very adamant that he would take it up with the War Office. And the brigadier said, all right. I respect your point of view, he said, but they will carry condoms, but they will be voluntary. They may do it, or they may not. So what actually happened was that the whole battalion was on deck of the Juana del Pacifico, and the commanding officer gave him a lecture about